This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll learn about a new COVID-19 testing lab on the UCSB campus.
We just got our approvals to be able to test people to determine which strain of the virus people have who test positive on campus, with their consent, of course.
Also, we'll hear a conversation with a local investment advisor about what's going on with the stock market.
Honestly, some of the most valuable studies have been less about the markets and more around cognitive biases and neuroscience. The markets are sometimes based on opinion and emotion.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, February 22nd. I'm Carol Tangeman. UC Santa Barbara recently opened a certified COVID-19 lab to meet the testing needs for students, faculty, and staff. Contributor Beth Thornton talked with two of the doctors overseeing the process.
This is Beth Thornton. I am joined today by UC Santa Barbara biologist Dr. Stuart Feinstein and Dr. Laura Polito. They lead the COVID-19 response at the UC Santa Barbara campus. Dr. Feinstein, let's start with some background on how the decision was made to establish a certified lab on the UCSB campus.
Go back to the early days of COVID, it was clear that the campus was going to need testing capability if it was going to operate and if they were going to be able to mitigate the growth of the pandemic. And so unlike UC medical centers, which already have diagnostic laboratories set up to test all sorts of maladies, what we had at UCSB is that the Student Health Center had a CLIA certified laboratory, but they weren't set up for COVID, and COVID was a completely different situation. So a decision was made on campus to set up a sort of an annex laboratory to the UCSB Student Health Laboratory, and that would be just to deal with COVID. So that required that we were starting with a zero. We had to start with just a couple of empty rooms, which were generously donated by the College of Engineering. And then we had to outfit it with all the equipment that you need. And then we had to set up the tests. And then we had to get good personnel in there to run all the tests. So that usually takes... Now, that can take a year or two, and we managed to do it all in about 4 or 5 months, actually, and get it to the level that we were able to get the CLIA certification to be able to do diagnostic testing.
And CLIA certification means what?
A certification that says that you've demonstrated that all your equipment is calibrated and working in perfect order, that your people know how to run all the tests, and that you can show that when you run the test versus other labs, some positives and some negatives, you get the same answers, so that your test results have credibility, so people can make good medical decisions on how to treat their patients.
UCSB made a decision to have the lab on campus as opposed to sending tests out. Is it more cost efficient to do it right on campus?
Well, we do both, actually. We do many hundreds of tests per day on campus, and that has one of the most important advantages of that is time. Time is everything in COVID. And you may remember back in the early days of COVID, there were lots of complaints in the media and everywhere that sometimes tests took 5, 7, 10, 12 days to come around. My opinion is that if it takes that long, it's not really medically that valuable any longer. When we do tests on campus, we get the results sometimes in 4 or 5 hours, at worst the next day. So that really helps to try to mitigate, to find people who are positive, get them in isolation or quarantine, and then you're controlling, you're mitigating progress of the disease through your community. We also do send some tests out. There's a really great facility that we've been working with down at UCLA called SwabSeq. And it's important to have multiple places to go with these tests because there could be a supply chain problem on a test, or there could be other problems that interfere with your ability to use a test. So if you have multiple tests available to you, we also had a test that was developed on our campus called CREST. So you need to have multiple players in the bullpen, basically, so you can call on them when you need them. We are now running on the order of 4,000 to 5,000 tests per week. We could go up considerably from there as the situation warrants. When we do it on campus, it is considerably less expensive. And the UCLA lab is also quite inexpensive. It's a sister UC campus, and they're not in it for profit. They're just, they have a different test, and it works real well, so we collaborate with them. In the private sector, you're certainly going to pay more than what we do on campus or at UCLA.
Are you able to identify the different virus variants that are popping up?
We just got our approvals to be able to test people to determine which strain of the virus people have who test positive on campus, with their consent, of course, that it's okay for us to sequence their virus. Based on what's happening everywhere else, it would be very surprising to me if we didn't have at least some variants in our community. But we'll see what the data says before very long at all, because the sequencing, now that we have the approval to do the sequencing, we just, it shouldn't take very long to determine what's in our community.
Dr. Polito, let's bring you into this conversation. Tell us what the current protocol is for students and the plan for testing students going forward.
Now that we have our testing program up and running with the lab that the campus has set up and with the external labs, we are working on testing the student population on a fairly regular basis, actually. Some studies have shown that frequent asymptomatic testing, looking for where the virus may be hiding in the community, particularly on a college campus where students don't really get severe symptoms from COVID, is one of the best ways, and actually one of the only ways we had for a long time, with interfering with this pandemic. So as we got things up and running, we've been testing the students who live on campus or are attending one of very few on-campus classes or working on campus are being tested once a week, as are the people that are going into the research labs. Again, very few of them, but they're all being tested once a week. As just routine on a routine basis. And then because the Isla Vista community is, you know, a very densely populated community, we realized early on that that was really the highest risk of virus transmission, was not necessarily what's going on campus, but what was going on off campus. So that's the point where we realized we needed to offer the testing to the students going, the students residing off campus, even though they were only remotely testing classes. So they are also offered testing once a week at no cost to them.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm joined today by UC Santa Barbara biologist Dr. Stuart Feinstein and Dr. Laura Polito.
We are running, you know, somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 tests a week. And we are also offering testing to the staff and faculty who may be on campus as well.
That will drastically change in the fall if school opens up again. 20,000 plus students and full staff on campus. Will this lab be able to handle that level of testing?
You're absolutely right about fall. Things will certainly scale up the further we get into this. And really, at the moment, nobody really knows what's going to be going on in the fall in terms of, you know, who will be on campus, who will be off campus, what the vaccine percentages will look like, whether or not we'll have any semblance of herd immunity by the fall. It's all kind of up in the air now, right? So we are planning on ramping up testing and contact tracing and case investigation as we go forward.
Tell us how you communicate with the students. Is there just a lot of texting? I mean, how do they get their appointments and know their results?
We do try to automate as much as we can for the students. All of the testing appointments are available online, and they're usually available either same day or the next day to make it most convenient for people to get tested when they need to. That is done all automated. We do also have people manning the phones so that if somebody does want to call and make an appointment and to talk about what maybe the best day to be tested would be. So we've got that available as well. We do send all of the results electronically to the portal in our electronic health record so that it's all secure. And then they get just a heads up text message that they've got something in their chart they need to look at. And that keeps it all confidential. And then we do also follow up with phone calls for all of the positive results. And then we talk to them about who they may have been in contact with. And then we make confidential phone calls to the contacts as well, to let them know that we're available if they need anything, to provide any medical advice or medical care they may need for the students, or to talk to the employees about resources that are available in the community for them.
With such a large, often asymptomatic population, given that most of the students are probably 18 to 25 years old, do you think you'll be able to identify some trends or potential research findings?
So once we start being able to sequence the virus, we are hoping to pick up some trends with that. We've actually also noted some trends already. The vast majority of our students are either asymptomatic or very mildly symptomatic. The most common symptom we've seen is actually the loss of taste or smell. And that seems to be very common in this age group. We have noticed a lot of the same patterns that other research has been done, although we're not doing research on it at this time. But we have noted things such as outbreaks do tend to be linked to super spreader events, and outbreaks do tend to be related to travel. So when people were coming in for the start of the winter quarter into Isla Vista, there were a lot of people who indicated that they'd been exposed at, you know, a New Year's party or a Christmas party and those kind of things. So we're noticing a lot of trends, but we have not done any research on that yet.
Do you anticipate transitioning to vaccines at some point?
Boy, we hope so. So the Student Health Center is actually a vaccine distribution site, and we are following the county recommendations for the healthcare workers and over 75s. Now, as a non-medical campus, we have obviously a lot smaller population of healthcare workers, but just like everybody, we're just waiting for vaccine supply.
That was Dr. Laura Polito and Dr. Stuart Feinstein from UCSB. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
Yosemite and the Sierra Nevada foothills are home to the Southern Sierra Miwok Nation, but the tribe has been enmeshed in a decades-long battle for recognition by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. To learn more about the current status of that fight and how it's been shaped by COVID-19, Kathleen Schock of KAZU spoke with Clay Moon River, Managing Director of the Miwumati Family Healing Center.
The Miwok, they have been in the fight for over 40 years. And what that looks like is working with attorneys and anthropologists and archaeologists to piece together the history, the narrative, and physical documentation, which also involves tribal enrollment processes, to demonstrate that the Miwok have always existed in the Yosemite region in Mariposa County region of California. Historically, there's the assumption that they were removed during the gold rush and were killed, or that other tribes who have been acknowledged historically are the only ones that still exist in this space here. And so part of this process is presenting to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They have an Office of Federal Acknowledgement, and they have review boards that review these documents of how many members are enrolled, and then also how often those enrolled members are participating in cultural activities to be defined as a contemporary culture. So the reason why the Miwok have struggled in the past to be acknowledged as a tribe is the findings from the Bureau of Indian Affairs as to why they've denied the acknowledgement is that from 1982 to 2011, they haven't had enough acting participatory members to prove that they're a contemporary society, which is offensive to the tribe because they have been acknowledged by the park, the national park systems, the state and local governments, because they've been involved with them for years. And there's no question that the Miwok were a tribe up until 1982. So currently they're working to document all the ceremonies and gatherings and powwows and ask people to sign in spaces you wouldn't normally, because of spiritual reasons, ask someone to sign in. And so it's sort of a really intense process. It can be triggering and re-traumatizing for tribal members to be asked to do something that other races and other people are not asked to do.
So I understand that there are some crucial deadlines that are coming up in terms of making your case for federal recognition. Is that right?
Yeah. So May 17th, is when the Miwok's attorney, and they're national, and they, one of their branches is in Sacramento, and they specialize in tribal rights. And so we have a strong team representing the tribe, and they are working closely with the tribal council to gather all the information to present again. So the last couple of years has been gathering surveys, almost like a community needs assessment, but a survey of tribal members so we can go back and ask questions from elders or people that have been present from 1982 to 2011, if they attended graduations and funerals and memorials and ceremonies and how often, to then sort of fill this narrative and this gap of them still existing and still being here. And so it's a lot of paperwork, and it takes a lot of trust in this system. And of course, a lot of us know that people of color do not have trust in systems. They were not built for us to succeed. In fact, they're built for us to be imprisoned and for, in some forms, modern day slavery. So it's hard to approach elders and say, can you fill out this survey so we can prove to the government that we exist?
To what extent has the pandemic factored into the work that you're doing?
We have had to shift to technology, which has not anything that the tribe is really interested in fully being on board with. It feels like a form of assimilation. Spiritually, culturally, we have so much tied to the land, and there's a generation, multiple generations in tribal communities that do not see technology as a good thing. And some of us do. We see that it has the benefit to support us in some aspects, but in other aspects removes us from the spiritual ties to the land. But the biggest thing is that we are in a rural area where internet connection, phone connection is challenging to begin with. But because of the economic status of the tribal members, they don't have running water or electricity or internet. It's not a priority. Their basic needs aren't even met. And so I would say more than half of the tribe actually don't even have the ability to stay connected in the ways that we need to. And it's been really detrimental because it's not safe to gather in the ways that we normally would be practicing our culture and practicing community. We're very intergenerational. And so we don't like having siloed meetings where just like one generation of people are making decisions for a whole group, a whole tribe. But having young youth all the way to elders being able to all have a voice is not happening right now. And that's fairly detrimental spiritually and politically and all the aspects of our cultural ways. So the pandemic is like really challenging us of like, how can we build resiliency and move forward? And what would our ancestors have done? And really reflecting on like what we would have to change to be a contemporary tribal community. What do we want to keep? Who gets to make those decisions about what we keep and what we let go of in order to move forward in a good way?
And then all this work takes money as well. How has fundraising been given the fact that people can't really gather in the way that they used to?
Yeah, that's been the hardest thing, because in tribal community, it's hard to explain to funders that we didn't have a financial loss. More what we really lost was our volunteers that ran everything. When you don't have the ability to have people safely show up to do food service or help run programming, tribal communities so really rely on their natural helpers and different levels of generations showing up to give their time to be part of the community and the culture. And so in ways that other, like not culturally specific nonprofits or agencies might have funding to support those programs, our programs have been run by their own people. And so the financial impact is hard to explain, but the fundraising effort is challenging in the fact that we are always sort of competing with Yosemite. And the attention, as soon as that name is mentioned, the attention goes to the national park. And people are more interested in supporting what might be happening there. And they also don't want to have to be responsible for any damages that they may have like unknowingly contributed to the oppression of the tribes there. Millions of people come on to the Southern Sierra Miwok homelands without even knowing whose homelands they're on and contributing to that erasure and acknowledgement of them being here. The biggest fees right now, which go into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, is to pay the attorneys and the anthropologists and the archaeologists for their time and efforts, and the fees that are associated with acquiring documents within other entities and agencies, and submission fees. And so we're spending more money than is coming in. And that is because there is no way to, that we have found yet, to really bring the attention to the Miwok in a good way.
Well, Clay River, we so appreciate you taking the time to share a bit of that history with us today. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Kathleen Schock of KAZU speaking with Clay Moon River, managing director of the Miwu Mati Family Healing Center. Working Lunch is a Facebook Live conversation with the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. Jim D'Antona will be speaking with Ryan Caldwell of Wacker Wealth Partners about what's going on with the stock market.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the Slow Chamber's weekly series, where we take some time to talk with our community leaders and help you connect to some of the things happening in our region. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the Slow Chamber, and today you'll get to be a part of my conversation with Ryan Caldwell, the CEO of Wacker Wealth Partners, a financial planning firm here in SLO. Today, he not only spends his time poring over stock market and investment charts, he is a highly engaged community member who has lent his expertise and guidance to organizations including Reach Central Coast, United Way, the SLO Food Bank, Leadership SLO. Having been in the industry for nearly 20 years, he's been side by side with clients through a lot of ups and downs in the market. I'm looking forward to talking to him today about getting his take on some of the more unusual stock market events we've seen in the last few weeks and months. Ryan, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure. As you know, I can never say no to the chamber.
We know, and we always appreciate it, and we always abuse it. Tell me about your roots on the Central Coast. Were you born and raised here?
Yeah, I wasn't born here, but mostly raised. My mom actually moved up to Paso Robles when I was about 9 years old. We moved from Southern California, and we moved up, we moved out of the city and into Paso. We lived about 15, 20 minutes outside of town on a couple of acres, and quickly got horses and goats, and my life changed pretty drastically at that point. And so I spent the rest of my growing up years here on the Central Coast, growing up in Paso with lots of animals and lots of hard work.
So growing up, you know, did you walk around with a Wall Street Journal under your arm or know you wanted to lead a financial planning investment firm from Paso there?
No, I had no idea. Matter of fact, growing up, I wanted to go into medicine. My mom worked in the dental industry. And so that was kind of the most tangible career path for me, was to become a doctor. I was always good at math and science. And so I wanted to, and I wanted to help people with my life. And so that seemed like a good fit. But I did have a little bit of a kind of a nerd streak growing up. You know, I'd find myself on Saturday mornings watching C-SPAN and watching the news, you know, while most kids, you know, couldn't care less. So from an early age, I was very interested in kind of geopolitical events. I also was fortunate to have an uncle who, you know, for Christmas one year gave me some Hasbro stock instead of buying me the remote control car I wanted. You know, from that point forward, I was always getting the paper out and looking for where the price of my stock was and learned about the stock market, even though I didn't really understand it. But I think that planted the seeds for what has now become a career. So grateful for that.
And so you went to school at Cal Poly. Did you get a degree in finance, business?
That would have been too simple, Jim. No, as I said, I had always wanted to go into medicine. So I got a degree in biology. And I got to the end of my undergrad at Cal Poly and realized in my last year, I really don't want to go to medical school and grad school. You know, I really just want to go out and work. I was just itching to get a job. And so I quickly kind of scrambled to make something of my bio degree. It's a very broad degree. It's really, really difficult, but it's not very useful unless you concentrate in something. And so I tried to concentrate in something at the end. It was somewhat of a failed attempt. And that lack of focus, I think, allowed me to really think about what I wanted to do early in my 20s, because really the sky was the limit at that point.
The investment area is not something you just kind of walk in one day and say, hey, I think I want to, you know, play around in the stock market. How did you get from, you know, biology to business or into where you are today?
Yeah, you know, I got a job through a friend, you know, working for a business that was, you know, somewhat in, related to the banking industry. And that just really expanded my mind as to what was out there. For me, that was a really good thing growing up, you know, with a single mom in Paso. I didn't have a huge sense for what was available. So that first job really expanded my horizons. And then, you know, when I was kind of done there, I really had the opportunity to say, well, what do I want to do? What do I like doing? I interviewed some people, some family, friends, and then decided to pursue the investment industry. And I found a firm up in the Bay Area at the time that was willing to hire a bio guy and teach me what I needed to know on the job. And of course, from there, I took, you know, additional coursework at night and audited classes at Cal Poly. I audited a accounting class at Cal Poly to kind of shore up some of those skills. So I've learned a lot along the way, but somewhat of a circuitous path. My wife and I were in the Bay Area enjoying life, but we knew that we never felt at home there. You know, we always kind of had this longing to get back to the Central Coast. And then my wife got pregnant and suddenly we had, you know, a clock ticking. I reached out to Bob Wacker, said, hey, this is who I am. I would love to work for you. And we moved down here. My wife was 8.5 months pregnant and we moved down here just in the nick of time. So
as we talk a little bit about what makes a great advisor, obviously you have a strong focus then on being a people-centered organization. Thinking about that in the larger view of individuals and personal connection, what about the larger industry in financial planning, investment? Is that going to continue to be the model, or do you think it's now becoming more automated and will be driven by individual investors on apps?
Mm. That's a good question. It's something that certainly, you know, comes up at all the conferences that I go to. You know, I draw the analogy to tax preparation and TurboTax. You know, TurboTax has been around for years. People have had the ability to do their own taxes. And TurboTax has gotten better and better. And, you know, it walks you through a process. It asks you questions. But what I found with working with clients is that there's a point at which their tax situation gets too complicated for TurboTax. And there's a point at which they need to ask someone a question, or it's so complicated, they're stressed out about whether or not they've done it right, right? And that's the point when someone needs a qualified tax preparation professional. And so to draw that analogy to our industry, investment management, financial planning, yeah, you can absolutely manage your own investments, you know, with a little bit of education. But there's a point at which your investments gets to be so large, or you begin to rely upon them for your livelihood to such a degree that, gosh, you might want to sit across the table from someone that's been doing this a while and ask some questions. You might want them to take it over for you. And so I think that analogy is going to ring true for our industry going forward. Absolutely, it's going to be better and easier, and the client experience for managing investments on Amazon or on Vanguard or whatever the platform is going to improve. But I think there are always going to be those folks that really want to sit across the table from a person, look them in the eye and get advice and get some confidence. And, you know, there's going to be those folks whose situation warrants that.
So in thinking about the market, and it does seem that having a person who spends all day thinking about what's happening, how much time do you think it really takes someone like yourself to make good decisions?
You know, and to your question as to how long it takes to gain the experience to be able to do it well, you know, I don't know. It's going to be different for everyone. But honestly, some of the most valuable studies have been less about the markets and more around cognitive biases and neuroscience. Because to your point, the markets are sometimes based on opinion and emotion, especially in the short term. You know, over the long term, we expect the value of companies to generally reflect how much they're earning and their sales and how much they're forecasted to earn in the future. But over the short term, you know, the stock prices can get completely disconnected from reality. And so learning how to manage that erratic behavior, learning how to see through it and understand that, you know, what is real and what is emotion. I mean, I think that's a really, really important skill. And I think that's a lot of the value that we add you know, to our clients, keeping them invested when things seem really, really scary, or keeping them from being too aggressive when things seem really positive, you know, like they have recently. You know, that kind of coaching, especially that psychological coaching, is really important to being a successful investor.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. The Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona is speaking with Ryan Caldwell of Wacker Wealth Partners.
You know, most of folks in our community can get invested. I absolutely think that people should not be intimidated by the investment markets. There are some great, you know, mutual funds or programs today. We call them robo-advisors, some great ways to get really good diversification in a way that's really simple. And that allows people to get invested and start seeing their assets grow, you know, beyond inflation and really start saving for retirement. And then when you build up a certain level of complexity, that's the point at which you want to start going and talking to an advisor. You know, that doesn't mean that people in their 20s aren't going to face difficult financial decisions, and some of which may warrant, you know, advice from a professional. And there are financial planners that will work on an hourly basis. And so that can be a good option for folks that just need to deal with a specific issue or perhaps create a long-term savings plan.
So let's kind of jump right back to the market. The market's been going pretty steadily up overall since the pandemic began, which seems a bit counterintuitive. As an advisor, what has been your kind of overall advice to your clients during this time?
Well, it's been primarily to stay the course. You know, I think, you know, we're having to remind our clients and ourselves every single day that we cannot predict the future. And the moment you attempt to do that, you are likely to be reminded of your humility. And so it's just continuing to coach them. You know, we don't know what's coming. We don't know what Congress is going to do next week. There could be a stimulus plan that completely upends the economic fundamentals of the situation. And so stay the course. We work with every single client to identify a certain level of risk in their portfolio that would be appropriate for them. And once we've determined that portfolio, that mix of primarily stocks and bonds, you know, that portfolio is meant to be ridden through these storms and through these ups and downs. And so that initial work is really important. And then the commitment to that work through the ups and downs of the market is just as important to be successful.
The press has done some talking about things like Bitcoin or GameStop that with all the press and people wanting to maybe jump on that bandwagon. From your perspective, did David slay Goliath in the GameStop AMC stock maneuvers, or is this likely just to have been a blip on the radar?
Well, I don't think it's a blip, but I wouldn't use the David and Goliath analogy. You know, I think a WrestleMania analogy is probably more appropriate. So, you know, the way I've tried to visualize this is that, and for those of you who haven't seen WrestleMania, and admittedly, I haven't seen WrestleMania in probably 30 years, but I remember as a kid, you know, you had like Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, and you have a bunch of wrestlers in a gigantic ring, and they're all just trying to beat each other up. And maybe there's a team, you know, component to it. But I think with the GameStop situation, what you had was, you know, on one team, you had some really large investors, some large hedge funds. And on the other team, you also had really large investors. I mean, that's what people don't realize is that some of the folks in the Reddit forum and some of the folks that were trying to upend the hedge funds, they were actually really wealthy individuals with really large stakes in the GameStop scenario. But they were also backed by this really large crowd of smaller investors. And that seems to get all the press. But what happened is these guys got in a ring and started beating each other up. And the most important thing to come out of it all is that in the process of beating each other up, they exposed some really interesting things about the ring, about the venue. For instance, the fact that GameStop is selling trade information, you know, for that their investors are making. And so that the company that they're selling it to can actually get in front of those trades and profit off that information. I don't think very many Robinhood investors realized that prior to this whole thing. And I think, you know, it took a wrestler to knock something over and reveal that truth for folks to wake up. So I think that is the most interesting thing to come out of all of this. There have been bulletin boards, stock bulletin boards, you know, as long as I can remember, where people will talk up various kind of pump and dump schemes, if you've heard of those, where you talk up a stock and then whoever gets out first, you know, gets to profit, but ultimately a lot of people get left holding the bag. Those things have been around forever. This is frankly just another one of those, you know, with maybe a little bit more of an interesting story. And so what's really sad to me is that a lot of folks were really kind of duped into the momentum of this. And I read a story in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, I think, around this gentleman who took out a $20,000 personal loan, you know, from like a payday lender, and he put it all in GameStop and lost most of it. And now he's still got to make those payments on that personal loan. And he's going to have a really, really difficult time recovering from this. So those are the real victims here, the folks that were excited by the Reddit form, got involved with money that they really couldn't afford to lose. And, you know, are going to spend a long, long time paying for it.
People bought into that kind of momentum without really understanding that GameStop might have been a dying stock to begin with, which is why there were people shorting it. And now you're paying $200 to $300 a share for it. You know, bad things can happen to people. And sure. So are there any other really common misunderstandings about the market you encounter?
Well, you know, you just hit on one of them, and that is that folks oftentimes don't understand the connection between the price of a stock and the company's fundamentals. They might look at two stocks and say, well, this one's priced at $100 a share and this one's priced at $50 a share. This one's twice as good or twice as big. I mean, they oftentimes don't know what that difference means. And, you know, I'd like to just tell our listeners today, it doesn't mean anything. Companies can issue a disparate number of shares. So you can have one company with 1,000 shares outstanding and another company with 100 shares outstanding. And so, you know, the prices of those of that per share amount can vary widely, and it really doesn't tell you anything about the value of the company or the success of the company. And so when you're analyzing stock, you got to look at that price, you know, relative to other things, that price relative to how much the company makes, that price relative to how much cash the company has on hand, relative to its sales. You know, there's a lot that goes into analyzing whether a company is fairly valued or appropriately valued. And most people don't look at any of that. They look at the price of the stock. Oh, it looks like it's doing well. You know, I would say that's the second big, you know, misconception or problem with individual investors, is that they oftentimes buy the things that have already done well, you know, which isn't always a bad thing. Sometimes things that have done well will continue to do well. But oftentimes, if something has done well, it means it's expensive, or maybe it means like it's already had its day in the sun, and now it's going to get attacked by competitors, and it's going to fight new resistance. So you never want to look in the rearview mirror when you're investing. You want to really analyze the fundamentals of a company, of a particular market, of a sector, before thinking about its future.
Ryan, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Jim.
That was the San Luis Obispo Chamber's Jim D'Antona speaking with Ryan Caldwell of Wacker Wealth Partners. And finally, on today's Playing with Food, Father Ian Dellinger takes us along as he discovers a tropical fruit grown locally.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. Anyone who has driven up and down Highway 101 on the Central Coast knows that there are so many different crops and groves and orchards and vineyards of many kinds of produce. It's what keeps Playing with Food in business. But what many people don't know is that when you take even the slightest turn to the east, there is even more fantastic produce, much of which you wouldn't think could grow here. One of those places to the east is Gobernador Canyon Road outside of Carpinteria, and one of those surprising crops is passion fruit. Yes, that dark purple wrinkly egg that looks like it has been in the bathtub way too long, native to the tropics and subtropics of southern Brazil, Paraguay, and northern Argentina, grows just east of Carpinteria. So, of course, I met up with Miguel to learn more about playing with passion fruit.
My name is Miguel Rodriguez, and we do a little bit of farming. My main work is landscaper, but this is my hobby.
Okay, your hobby is pretty big. Driving up here, there's a lot of avocados and oranges, and we're here to look at other things, right?
Yeah, we have a bit of a passion fruit, we have dragon fruit, and we have also chirimoyas and some avocados, as well as pepino melons. The weather in this area is kind of a little microclimate that allows us to grow certain things, pretty much tropical stuff.
Where is passion fruit from originally?
Well, that's a good question. I believe it's Central and South America, and it grows all over the world now in tropical areas. As you can see, it grows pretty well in here. This is plants that are maybe a year and a half, 2 years old. That's a new plant right there, a baby plant that's maybe a couple of months old. And that plant in 6 months should be all the way up to the top and start fruiting.
So it's about 1 foot, and in 6 months, it's going to be about 5 feet.
Five feet and then branching out. Passion fruit grows pretty fast. It reaches up to the top wire, and then it grows 10, 20 feet to each side.
Okay, and it's a vine?
It is a vine, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Passion fruit season starts in mid-July, and it ends about the end of March. As you can see right now, we have a few fruits on them. They're going to start busting out a lot of blossoms, and those blossoms will be the next fruit for July.
Like orange trees, it'll blossom with fruit still on it.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, okay. It does. We still have fruit on it. In a couple of weeks, you're going to see a lot of blossoms, and we're still picking whatever, you know, is left over from the last season. We started with about 1,500 plants and increased it by almost 2,000 on both parcels, that one and this one right here. I would say that now we have maybe about 1,000 left because we lost a lot of them to the fire that we had 2 years ago around here. And so I think we're down to about 1,000.
When you harvest that, how long does it take you to harvest the 1,000 plants?
It is hand harvest, yeah. We walk through each road and pick up the fallen fruit on the ground. We don't pick it from the plant. You're not supposed to pick it from the plant. You have to wait until it drops to the ground. That's when it's ready. When that happens, every morning during the heavy fruiting, we have guys walking up and down, picking up the fruit so it doesn't get burned. This fruit is delicate for the sun. Once it gets off the plant, sun can burn it. And so if it burns it, it's still good inside, but it's not good for the market.
We want pretty fruit.
Exactly. That's what customers want. Pretty fruit. Yeah, they don't want to see a scorched fruit. We never get too cold in here. As you can see, this is way up high from the sea level. I think we're probably anywhere from the 600, 700, maybe 800 feet. It gets cold at the bottom, you know, where the river goes by. That's where it gets a little colder. But up here, it tends to stay about 35 at the lowest. These plants can handle 35 and above. If it goes below 32, you can have problems.
Then the real fun started. We got into Miguel's UTV and headed toward the vines.
Okay, hop on it. I'll give you a little tour. This is another section of passion fruit that we're growing from babies.
Oh, I was gonna get a picture of a baby. Can I get a picture of a baby?
Sure, okay. Of course. So even though we're in a higher part of the hills here, where there is low areas, we tend to get a little frost bite if the temperature drops low. You can see the difference between here, 100 feet away, which is 25 feet higher, you can see the sugar cane got a little toast on the leaves right there, and that is due to a cold night. As you can see, instead of using pesticides and stuff like that, we use weed eaters to cut the grass and let that break into the ground to become nutrients.
There's a drip system all through here. How water intensive are passion fruit?
They don't like too much water. They're kind of a moderate plant, but they don't like clayey soil. They like to be in a soil that it drains very well. So they're quite sensitive to a lot of water. And if there's a lot of water, they need to be in a very sandy soil so that it filtrates quite quick.
How much rain do you get down here when it's not a drought?
Good question. Our typical rain season is anywhere from 15 to 17 inches a year, if we get lucky. That would be our normal season. Other than that, you know, we could go 4 or 5 years in a drought, and that's a different story.
So we just walked by passion fruit that's on the ground. So that's perfectly ripe and ready to go.
The fruit has been released by the plant by itself. It's just, it drops in the ground. And this is what could happen when it's not picked up the same day. So you start seeing the sun, the wrinkly part. which the fruit remains the same is good, but when you send it to the markets, when it gets packed in the packing house, they want to see it all smooth and nice and no scratches, so the fruit keeps its value and aesthetics. But in reality, the fruit itself inside is the same.
If you pick too early, is there a taste difference?
No. The passion fruit is actually a fruit that when you pick the fruit being fallen from the plant itself, it's a little tangier. It's a little more tarty. If you let it sit a couple of weeks, maybe up to 3 weeks, if you want to hold it until it gets totally wrinkled, then it enhances the flavor. It gets a lot sweeter.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Father Ian, picking passion fruit with Miguel, east of Carpinteria.
So how long does it take for the bud to turn into fruit?
It's probably a process that could be maybe a good couple of weeks, 3 weeks maybe. And that's when you start seeing tiny little fruit. The flower matures and it shrivels and falls off, and the little fruit starts from nothing.
And it's green?
It's green, yeah.
Totally green.
And as it matures, it starts changing color. In fact, you can see one in there, a baby fruit in there at the bottom.
Yeah.
You see the purple one? And then the down below from that, that's a baby fruit right there. That's probably a month old fruit.
Okay.
And it starts being green to the point that it's ready to go. It's total purple. This is a flower that has done its course, and now it's starting to develop in a new fruit. Some of them take, some of them don't, but look at this one right here. It's already a tiny little ball inside there. You see that little green thing?
So the flower closes in order to...
The flower closes to protect the fruit itself, and eventually it dries, and it just allows the fruit to grow, and the flower shrivels and falls off.
That is amazing.
Tiny little fruit inside already. You can see it right there. When the fruit is still growing, and the flower is still attached to the stem. So as you can see, from here to here, it's another, you know, week or so, and it dries, and then it falls off, and then the fruit starts developing.
That's cool. That's really cool. So what about this fruit? This fruit looks damaged. What happened to that one?
Some of these get damaged to the weather. If there is a lot of water at one point, if it gets cold, they get cracked. It's very unusual to see this happening on passion fruit. You see this happening more on cherimoyas.
What are the two varieties that you grow?
We grow the Frederick and this one, which is the Black Knight. Same family, just different varieties.
Which ones are preferred in the supermarket?
That's hard to say. Both of them are very well liked. People tend to ask sometimes for the Black Knights when they're in season, when we have them, just because they're a little sweeter. As they fall from the plant, they're already sweeter, a lot sweeter than the other varieties. So that's probably the only difference in between them.
But people sometimes like bigger fruit.
That's right, yeah. When it comes to that, they prefer the other variety because the Black Knight is a lot smaller and see less for your money. But in reality, it's not a problem because we sell it by weight, so you always get a pound.
Once Miguel showed me how passion fruit grows, we headed back down to the area where the fruit was packed and ready for local delivery.
That is passion fruit that was picked today and the ones that were picked a couple of days ago.
So these bins are full of passion fruit. What's your biggest market?
When we have a lot of fruit, majority goes to the packing house. But we love to go to the markets, farmers markets, to bring it to people so it comes direct from the grower to them. It's fresh and clean.
So you said that these should need to wait 2 or 3 weeks to get sweeter?
From the time that the fruit falls off the plant to where it can be the best would be anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks. The fruit shrivels, but it doesn't damage the inside of the fruit itself. So it's only the skin that shrivels up. Somehow it just gets sweeter.
So do you wait to take them to market until they're shriveled?
We have a combination because people like to have both. They like to have the fresh, soft ones so that they can make them last. And we also have the shriveled ones, and we mix them so that everything is available for the client. So if they want to eat one today, like right now, they can have one like this, shriveled up. And it's tastier than something like this. So easily the fruit can last up to 3 weeks before it starts to get dry. And even when it's dried outside, it's still good inside.
Can we see what one looks like on the inside?
Of course. So we'll cut off a shriveled one so that you can see the insides of it.
That's really pretty.
In fact, if you want to try it, you can taste it. A beautiful color. These are the seeds right there. And you eat the seeds, you want to crunch them because they're loaded with a lot of iron in them.
So when you open one up, it's got purple skin, and then it's pure white on the inside of the skin. That's kind of interesting.
It's kind of a insulation type of skin. You'll see that in a fresh fruit better than what you can see here, because this is already starting to shrivel up and the color is kind of sinking into the inside part of it. But yeah, it's an amazing type of insulation that preserves the fruit in good conditions inside.
Is it the same kind of thing as the pith on an orange?
Okay. Very similar.
And then we've got this bright orangish gold flesh.
That's the flesh and seeds combined.
And then these seeds. Yeah, these seeds. And the seeds, you can't separate them.
This is a fresh fruit that was picked today. And you can tell the difference inside the skin. There's a lot of white material in there. That's the insulation part.
And the flesh is still kind of connected to the...
Yeah, the flesh remains connected to the inside part of the fruit.
And that one's really watery. The one with the smooth skin has a lot of water in it.
It has a little more water, but as you can see, the color changes a little bit by aging of the fruit. The one that you're holding right now, it's tastier than this. This would be very tangy.
I'm going to try a tangy one first, okay? It's delicious.
It's actually a very unique fruit. People love it for the taste. People ask me, what can I compare it with? And I tell them flat out that there is nothing you can compare it with. Right. This is a very unique fruit. The flavors in it, it's just unique.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm going to try the shriveled one. It's sweeter.
Sweeter.
And it's got a slightly different flavor.
It does. It's actually what people tend to like to get from the farmer's market when we bring it to them. Because it's a little more mild, it's a lot sweeter. Although there is people that like it fresh like that and very tangy. Mm. My personal taste is this. It's got to be shriveled out for a week or two.
Hey, let me try to get that.
Squeeze it into your mouth. Amazing flavor, huh?
It's a really nice taste, and I can understand why people want to make things out of it. It's really delicious.
People use it in many different ways, and they ask me what I do with it. And my favorite thing that I do with it is make a tea.
Oh.
Yes, you cut out the fruit in half, squirt it into the teapot, and boil it. Once you reach the boiling point, let it boil like for 3 minutes with skin and all, everything in the pot. You can sweeten it with honey. That's what I do. It smells good. Flavor is amazing. And it is actually very relaxing. It can help you to sleep and relax your body at nighttime.
Other than the tea, what do you do with them? What do you do with them?
Well, you can have them in your yogurt. You can have them in a salad. You could have a cocktail with it. You can cut one on the top and pour some vodka or tequila, whatever your preference may be. Mix it in there, and there you go. You have a shot.
I'm definitely going to try that.
Feel free. Don't tell anybody I told you so. But it's actually a very common thing in the bars. They actually use that also for like passion fruit margaritas and other drinks. Mm. So yeah, cocktails is a good thing for, this fruit is good thing for cocktails.
Where do you nursery them or where do you get them?
We make plants out of cuttings, out of the same plant. So you get a new vine like this and cut the plant at the bottom right here and leave one leaf on it. Pinch this leaf and you can submerge this in root tone and put it in a little container with soil. And you can start a new plant. I'll show you the plants that we have in a minute. We're already growing them for the season. But that's basically how you get the plants going a little faster way, rather than using seeds.
You said they're 1 to 2 years old. How long do they last?
The life of these plants is not too long. I mean, it could be maybe 6-7 years pushing it. But they start dropping and are very sensitive to root rot. Yeah, I would say that average is about 5 years. I order some plants from Florida, and I started to buy plants from like Home Depot. You can find them at Home Depot. And once we had a certain number of plants, we made our own plants out of the same plants.
A lot cheaper.
A lot cheaper, yeah. And a bigger supply.
Yeah.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Father Ian, having just picked passion fruit with Miguel, and now wondering what the best way to play with it is. I turn to my good friend and mixologist, Dusty Collier-Worth.
Dusty, welcome back to Playing with Food.
Thanks for letting me come back.
I've been interviewing people about passion fruit, and I tried to do some playing with food with passion fruit. I did what the grower told me to do, and the grower told me to cut it in half, loosen the flesh, pour my favorite spirit in there, and drink it like a shot. That was the extent of my experimenting with passion fruit. But I also made some passion fruit simple syrup that I can use in cocktails, in baking, or whatever. So I, again, devolved my responsibility of playing with food to you, the mixologist. And what did you do with the passion fruit?
Your instructions were not far off, just because passion fruit has such a wonderful flavor on its own. I, like-minded, know that it makes an amazing syrup. So I took some of those passion fruit and made a delightful syrup. Then I started thinking about passion fruit has not only this kind of fruit flavor to it, it also has a floral quality to it, as well as it is, it can be quite tart. You know, it does have some kind of that sourness to it that balances along with that kind of tropical flavor that is distinctly passion fruit. So it just got me thinking that this might go with the floral qualities and the fruit and the tart, that that's going to go in a gin fizz. So I kind of made my passion fruit syrup and added that into a gin fizz. So a classic gin fizz also involves some egg whites. So I know some people kind of get weird about raw eggs in a cocktail, but it's been a traditional cocktail ingredient for quite some time. And I think that it really adds some amazing silky texture to a cocktail, as well as when you see those photos of cocktails that have beautiful foam line, that's from the egg white. It almost makes this kind of soft meringue when you're shaking it with something that has the acid and the alcohol-based spirit. I did also add a couple of basil leaves, pulling out that kind of floral quality again, where basil has that floral, subtly licorice-y flavor that I thought was going to really pull something out of the passion fruit, and they blended flawlessly together. I feel like I might still have one or two left. They also are just delicious to snack on. I'm all like, I know we want to play with them, but sometimes just having a little passion fruit snack is delicious.
Okay, I'm looking at the ingredients, and you said it was a classic gin fizz, but except for the gin and the egg whites and the basil leaves, yeah, all of these ingredients are things I've never heard of.
You know, a honey liqueur, there are several different honey liqueurs out there. I mean, probably one of the most classic that people have heard of is something like Benedictine, is kind of like a honey-based liqueur. Has a lot of other botanicals on there, so it can be kind of a strong flavor. You can make a honey syrup, which is usually just equal parts honey and water, but instead of doing it that way, do it with honey and vodka, and suddenly you've got a honey liqueur. Just something that has a super sweet honey flavor, but also that alcohol content.
And I'm sure the honey really enhances the passion fruit flavor.
It's, again, it's playing off of those, when you start pulling things apart, passion fruit has that kind of fruit flavor that is distinctly passion fruit. But it's also, like I said, those fun things that where we start picking out the floral qualities in fruit and how honey really also enhances those floral qualities because, well, you know, it starts with flowers somewhere along the way before it becomes honey.
Is passion fruit something that you will continue to use in your mixology?
Oh, I think it lends itself really phenomenal to crafting cocktails. It is a really fun and luxurious ingredient to play with in cocktails.
If you have never eaten passion fruit, go for it. The season is just about to end next month in March, and then pick up again in July. Get plenty of them, make sure they sit on your counter until they're very wrinkly, and then just cut them open, scoop out the seeds and flesh with a spoon, and enjoy. There are plenty of recipes on the internet for ways to use the passion fruit, but make sure you don't hide its bright and unique flavor. The Central Coast has a never-ending supply of great foodstuffs. We here at Playing with Food encourage you to do your own exploration and play with food to your heart's content. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm Playing with Food.
Father Ian Dellinger was exploring the possibilities of locally grown passion fruit with farmer Miguel Rodriguez and mixologist Dusty Collier-Worth. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.